Today is a real pleasure to welcome Larry Widrow from Queen's University, you know, for our first back in person Cosmos seminar. So Larry is a really well known cosmologist who's made just like, you know, tremendously important contributions across a range of topics in cosmology. So, for example, you know, for dark matter people, Larry is extremely well known, you know, for his famous Tolleson-Widrow calculation of the stellar neutrino dark matter abundance. He's also well known for the Widrow-Kaiser wave function for axion dark matter, which I've been using a lot recently. He's also done really important work on the origin of cosmological magnetic fields. More recently, though, so he's been really interested in the structure of our in our halo. So in particular, so Larry's written some very interesting papers using Gaia data to learn about the Milky Way. And so in his talk today, he'll be telling us about some of his recent work. So please take it away, Larry.
Great, thank you. And thanks everyone for coming. It's great. This is my first in-person talk outside of Kingston. So it's good to be back to an in-person talk and good to see that we're all working out the bugs of setting up in-person talks. Let me begin by saying that the title for this talk, In the Balance, Stasis, and Disequilibrium in the Milky Way, is borrowed from a workshop that I went to at the Kavli Institute and an associated conference. Here's the poster, and this was right before, you know, sort of 1 year before the pandemic era. So originally this talk was going to be kind of what I did over my sabbatical talk, and then things got delayed and delayed and delayed. But I've been, of course, adding things as my graduate students and I have continued to work on some of these problems. So the overview of this talk is, I'll begin with a introduction to equilibrium models for disk galaxies. Then talk about the local gravitational field and local dark matter density in the Milky Way, an old problem first thought about by Oort in the 1930s. And then talk about disequilibrium in the Milky Way, all the different manifestations that we have to indicate that our galaxy is not in equilibrium. And in particular, something called the phase spirals or the Gaia phase spirals, which I think are one of the most intriguing results to come out of Gaia, and then we'll revisit the Oort problem and see how the phase spirals come into that story. So let's think about the Milky Way. The Milky Way galaxy is the closest edge-on galaxy to the Sun. We sit at the about 8 kiloparsecs from the galactic center. The galactic center is characterized by a bulge and bar, which account for about 10 or 20% of the mass in the Milky Way. But basically, we're viewing the galaxy as a thin disk that's partially obscured by dust. And also in this picture, I guess that's not going to work, we have the large and small Magellanic clouds, and these satellite galaxies are going to play an important role in the story for today's talk. So the disk of our galaxy clearly shows features that suggest that it's time dependent. It's not exactly in equilibrium. We see a prominent bar and spiral structure, but it's still instructive to think about how we can calculate or at least construct equilibrium models for the galaxy. And so let's think about some of the global features of the galaxy. So the galaxy has a stellar mass of about 5 times 10 to the 10 solar masses. You can azimuthally average the surface density and find that it, like many disk galaxies, falls off exponentially with radius with an exponential scale length of about 3 kiloparsecs. And we have an orbital period here at the position of the Sun of about 200 million years and a rotation speed of 200 or 250 kilometers per second. So how do we think about a model for the galaxy? Well, we have models for the galaxy, for at least the stellar disk of the galaxy, are described by a phase-based distribution function that gives us the density of stars as a function of position, velocity, and time. So a 6-dimensional plus time function. This couples to itself and to the dark matter halo through the gravitational potential. The stars in the disk are essentially collisionless, and that means that essentially they're moving in the mean field, gravitational field of the galaxy. So for the disk of the galaxy, star-star encounters are negligible, unimportant, exceedingly rare. That wouldn't be true if you were doing globular clusters or open star clusters, where you have to consider the star-star interactions. And the potential and distribution function are connected through Poisson's equation and the collisionless Boltzmann equation. So it's essentially solving that coupled system of equations that gives us virtually all of galactic dynamics. The distribution function and potential for an equilibrium system are time independent, so that's a simpler problem. And a moment's thought would suggest to you that if you're building an equilibrium model for the galaxy, you begin with assumptions of axisymmetry and symmetry about the midplane of the galaxy. So if you want something time independent, then you should have those two symmetries built into your model. So a model for the galaxy is built out of orbits of individual stars. And what characterizes the disk of the galaxy is that the stars are on nearly circular orbits. And so we can think of the disk of the galaxy as being dynamically cold. The random motions of stars in the vicinity of the sun are about 10% of the circular motion around the center of the galaxy. So they have random motions of about 10 or 20, 30 kilometers per second compared with 250 kilometers per second for the orbital motion. And that's in contrast with the halo stars, the stars in the bulge and the dark matter, which are dynamically hot systems. So how can we think of constructing an equilibrium model for the disk? Well, a good way to think about the orbits of stars in the disk are that they are a superposition of three different oscillatory motions. And so the first motion is the one that sort of immediately comes to mind of stars on circular orbits around the center of the galaxy. And as we all learned in our first physics courses, to a good approximation, even for flattened systems like the galaxy, that circular speed is just related to the mass interior to your orbit. We can also think about that orbital frequency. That's a more useful quantity for what I'm about to describe. And the orbital frequency then is goes like the velocity over the radius, obviously, and that's roughly given by the mean density inside your orbit to the 1/2 power. So it's interesting that galactic disk is roughly intermediate between two special cases for the potential. One is the Kepler potential, in which you have a velocity that falls up as r to the minus half. And the other is the harmonic potential or constant density potential, in which the velocity increases linearly with radius, essentially solid body rotation. And galactic rotation curves tend to thread between these two extreme cases of the Kepler case and the constant density case. And you see that either in velocity or in frequency. And so you can see how you could build up, say, a galaxy with a particular surface density if you're building this model. You label orbits by their angular momentum, which is an integral of motion. And then you simply paint on the density as a function of angular momentum, where angular momentum can be thought of as a proxy for the radius of the galaxy. And so if you want an exponential function for the surface density profile, that's telling you a distribution of orbits as a function of their angular momentum, again, where angular momentum is related to that radius of a circular orbit. So that's the first ingredient. So of course, stars don't move on perfect circular orbits. In the Kepler problem, stars would move on elliptical orbits with the sun, with the center of the potential at one of the foci. And in that case, a star is making one radial oscillation for every trip around the center of the potential. And so we have a new frequency in the problem, which we call kappa, the frequency of radial oscillations. In this case, kappa is proportional to omega. On the other hand, if we go to the solid body case, then you're making, again, an elliptical path, a closed elliptical orbit. But this time you're making two radial oscillations for every one oscillation around the center of the potential. So here, kappa equals 2 omega. And in the galactic case, which is intermediate between the two, you're no longer moving on closed elliptical orbits. You're moving in these rosette orbits between these two cases of closed elliptical orbits. And you can think a little bit about your sort of how this fed into your first quantum mechanics courses, but a different story. But anyway, these rosette orbits then are what we're going to build our galactic model out of. And so for a specific angular momentum, then you can look at the circular orbit and the orbit of a star in one of these rosette patterns, and the rosette pattern lags behind that circular orbit. And you can see this most clearly if you go to the rotating frame, and in that case, the circular orbit just stays in one position in the rotating frame of the particle on perfect circular orbit. And then that particle that's moving on this rosette pattern takes this epicyclic motion lagging behind the circular orbit. And so we often talk about these epicyclic motions reminiscent of the epicycle models of Ptolemy in the old system of the solar system, old models of the solar system. So we now have a second ingredient. We can talk about an energy relative to the energy of a particle on a circular orbit at fixed angular momentum and how we populate that space of in-plane energy relative to circular motion energy tells us the random motions of stars in the R5, VR, V5 plane. So that's the random motion of stars in the plane of the disk. So the final component is related to vertical oscillation. So stars not only just moving in the disk of the galaxy, but they're bobbing up and down. And close to the midplane, that vertical motion and the in-plane motion couple to a reasonable approximation. And so we can look at the vertical phase space. And this will be a key part of the talk as we go forward. And so you can plot the vertical velocity, the motion, the velocity normal to the midplane of the galaxy and the position relative to the midplane of the galaxy as a ZVZ phase space. And so in that phase space, individual stars move in a clockwise fashion around the center of that 2D slice through phase space. So any questions, people should just chime in. But so we're going to come back to this question. Projection of phase space. Yeah.
You're not including in your model the dust and the gas components, which we know are in different components, for example, giant molecular clouds versus the hot gas, which is therefore out of equilibrium. Is it a good approximation to neglect the coupling with that non-equilibrium sector?
I would say we know not only that the gas system, that their gas system's out of equilibrium, but also the stars are out of equilibrium. So this equilibrium model is really meant to be a starting point for simulations and analysis of data and exploring the disequilibrium of the galaxy. Okay. So there's lots of different ways in which the galaxy is out of equilibrium, including, as you say, the gas component. And here we're just looking for sort of a simple starting point to explore that dynamics. I don't know if that helps.
So we will be coupling the gas and the dust.
In this talk, I only have one slide that has gas component simulations in it, but it's an excellent question as to how the gas would figure into the story as we go forward.
Great, thank you.
Right, so the stars in this ZVZ plane have a frequency which depends on the potential as you go up out of the midplane. And so you can think of a vertical energy. And so now we have our three ingredients for constructing, again, this equilibrium model. We have the circular motion, which tells us the surface density as a function of angular momentum. There's the in-plane motion relative to circular motion, which tells us the amount of random motion in the plane of the galaxy. And then there's the random motion in the vertical direction. And so you can think of multiplying these three things together as combining these three different types of oscillatory motion. And many people, including Konrad Keuken and John Dubinsky and then myself and many others, have developed various codes for building models of galaxies under this assumption. Others have used, instead of these energies, the action variables. You go to angle action space. This is mainly work with James Binney and McMillan and others. And there are now codes available to build these types of galactic models.
Can I ask something?
Yeah.
Sigma R and sigma Z, they are, assume they're constant, but I guess they could define them on R.
They can be functions. So if you're building things out of these energies, which are approximate conserved quantities, then they can be functions of R. But you want to be careful and not use R, but rather RC, the radius of circular orbits at given angular momentum, and then they're functions of the angular momentum. So again, the angular momentum is this proxy for radius. And so in fact, we are building models where sigma r is a function of the radius of a circular orbit at fixed angular momentum in a given potential. So that's how you get a sigma r and a sigma z that depend on radius.
So this rc is really a function of angular momentum.
It's a function of angular momentum, right? So this distribution function, probably a better way of writing that would be F as a function of LZ, E energy in the plane, which is approximately conserved, and vertical energy, which is approximately conserved. So it's a function of three conserved quantities in equilibrium. Yeah. And the action idea is to take that sort of a step further in the dynamics and use the action variables, which are exactly conserved, but harder to compute.
Larry, it's Mike Fick. Isn't sigma z also a function of z?
Sigma.
The velocity dispersion in z direction potentially could be a function of the height above the plane.
That's right. So that comes sort of out through the dependence of sigma z on LZ. And how the model constructs the self-consistent potential. So you end up with sigma z that can depend on z, but it's sort of an indirect way through the potential, which comes into the other integrals of motion. Right? So sigma z is a parameter which depends only on the angular momentum, but the model builds in things like a vertical velocity dispersion that can have a z dependence. And of course, you can build in different components as well. So we in almost two slides, I'll show a thin disk, thick disk model where that's built in explicitly, which is the main one of the, you know, sort of an easy way of thinking about that sigma z dependence.
Yeah, it was the thin versus thick disk exactly that I was thinking about when I asked the question.
Good. And that'll come in at the end of the talk if we get there. So there's a nice connection with that as well. So thanks for that question. So here's sort of a rotation curve or circular speed curve that you can build out of the model. It shows this asymmetric drift effect, which we talked about earlier. Here's a model that Nathan Degg and I and others used for the Milky Way. So here we have a thin disk, a thick disk, a gas component. So, you know, if you're as part advertising this code that's been developed over the years. So if you want to do isolated galaxy simulations, then you can, you know, build or take one of our favorite Milky Way models and evolve it and see what happens. And you can see that even though it's an equilibrium model, it's not a stable equilibrium. You form bars and spiral structure out of the instabilities that are inherent in all of these models.
And excuse me, one more question. Is it natural or does it have to be imposed that the that the velocity curves go flat when you're far from the center.
That's all built into the model. So you can, by trial and error, or we've even developed various MCMC type schemes, put in some desired properties of the galaxy, real observations, or just some rotation curve that you want, and then tune the 15 or so parameters in the model to give you that a galaxy that looks like that.
And so, is it natural to get the Tully-Fisher relation?
So that's a good question. So again, I think these are things that you would build into. So these models don't, you know, they sort of give you what you put in terms of the parameter space. If you wanted to sort of go through models and ask, you know, if I impose this condition, you know, say not too unstable to bars or something like that, do I get out Tully-Fisher? Then you could do that sort of exploration of parameter space. Okay. So none of this is built into the model. So the model just allows you to produce whatever galaxy you want. That galaxy may look nothing like the galaxies in the real universe. You have to put in the physics in choosing the parameters of the model.
Great.
But just to clarify, so you are adding a dark matter halo such that it plus whatever the stars are doing gives you something that has a flat rotation curve?
That's right. So we build, if we want to build a Milky Way model, we put in the Milky Way rotation curve, velocity dispersion profile, what we think the surface density profile looks like, the local velocity, the local dark matter density. You can put all that stuff in, the Oort constants, throw it into a big MCMC chain and spit out the galactics parameters that give you that model. So that's how, you know, some of these were constructed.
But is it natural? But the point about the Tully-Fisher relation is that the asymptotic velocity does not depend on the dark matter. It depends only on the baryonic matter.
One more time,
relation says that the asymptotic velocity is determined only by the baryonic matter, by G times the M of the baryonic matter, and does not depend on the dark matter.
Right, but you can, since you know all the parameters, you know where the baryons are, you can build in whatever relation you want between any of these quantities. So Tully-Fisher or mass velocity, you know, mass radius, or any of the scaling relations that you like. So you can, you know, it might be an interesting thing to just take all the different scaling relations that we have and then allow the code to produce different galaxy models and see what they look like.
Sure, okay.
So, so to get to this idea of the local density of dark matter, one can write down in the approximation that the vertical structure decouples from the in-plane structure. You can write down a simple equation, which looks just like the equation for hydrostatic equilibrium, and then relate this to the total density of mass in the solar neighborhood. And this is something that has come to be known as the Oort program or Oort problem, to measure the density and dispersion of some tracer population in the solar neighborhood, infer the vertical potential, compute the total density via Poisson's equation as above, and subtract the density of known objects, the stars, gas, and dust. And that gives you a local density of dark matter. And I note that in 1932, Oort wrote a third purpose of his classic paper with a rather clunky title, but on the force exerted by a system in the direction vertical perpendicular to the galactic plane. A third purpose was a derivation of an accurate value of the total amount of mass, including dark matter, corresponding to a unit luminosity in the surroundings of the sun. 1932, 4 years before Zwicky uses the term dark matter, not in the maybe most modern sense. And you can even find similar statements in the earlier paper by Kaptan And all this goes back to some beautiful work by Jeans. So there's wonderful stuff in the old literature.
Sorry, are you saying dark matter was not invented by Zuiki?
I'm saying that that already prior to Zwicky, Oort was thinking, gosh, we can get everything, not just the stuff we see. And he called it dark matter.
Like stars that are...
He meant stars and, you know, and whatever, you know, stuff that we weren't looking at. But it was gravity could tell you about the things even if you don't observe them directly, observationally. And he never, you know, he had 100 stars or so, and there was no evidence for this in the data that he had. But, you know, you're still thinking about this idea in the galactic setting.
Who came up with the word dark matter, dude?
I think Zwicky was the one who had the observation, you know, who assigned that term, I think, to an observation, right? I mean, I think that's
right. Zwicky was thinking only about clusters.
Oort's paper, you know, was probably the first paper that on galactic dynamics that had, you know, something really correct about the dynamics of the galaxy. So this is in some ways the beginning of the modern galactic dynamics.
Right. And then Vera Rubin experimentally confirmed that there was missing matter in the Milky Way.
So let's turn to the next topic in the course, which is departures from equilibrium. And it's really obvious that galaxies are not in equilibrium. You have prominent bars in some galaxies. You have interactions, possibly exciting spiral structure merging and so forth. And even in our own galaxy, there's the famous NASA JPL image that everyone shows. But more recent studies of spiral structure have shown that, you know, the Milky Way has this very complicated spiral structure throughout the disk. And galaxies also have departures from planarity. You have some of the classic so-called integral sign warps that we see in edge-on galaxies. And this has been mapped fairly carefully in the Milky Way galaxy itself. And so you're seeing the Milky Way has rather complicated warping, but roughly an M equals one warp of a few kiloparsecs as you get out to the edge of the disk. You know, how do we think about these? Well, we've already seen in Nathan's simulation, but you know, if you set up an equilibrium model for the galaxy, it will almost certainly develop structures through dynamics. And so these equilibrium models aren't necessarily stable. In fact, they're almost all of them are unstable, and they're unstable to the formation of bars and spiral structure. I don't want to get into too much of the actual dynamics of the bar instability, but it's roughly akin to the Jeans instability, since this is a cosmology seminar. Everyone's familiar with the Jeans instability. Basically, that one is overcoming the pressure or effective pressure due to velocity dispersion through gravitational effects. And so there's roughly a Jeans length in the disk of the galaxy. One can also form bending of the disk even in these isolated systems. And so here's a set of simulations that a former graduate student of mine, Matt Checkers, did. So in the top, we have two rows of results for the surface density of two galaxies built with this galactics code. One has a heavy disk and relatively light halo, and it forms a very strong bar. And the other is more stable to bar formation. It has a much lighter disk. And so you're building one of these models and you form a big, heavy bar and you want to turn off bar formation, just make the disk lighter and the halo a little bit heavier for the same rotation curve and you make a more stable model. That was actually the Ostreicher Peebles argument pre-Rubin and Ford. But you also see in both cases displacements at the edge of the disk. And so one tends to form waves, vertical waves in the disk that propagate out toward the edge. And you produce warps, not quite the amplitude that we see in our own galaxy, but you can produce these warps just out of the kind of random noise of the simulation and the dynamics of the system. And these are essentially bending waves of the disk, and they're actually complementary to the genes instability. If you think of a thin disk and stars moving in the plane, and you have create a small bend, then if you have a very short wavelength bend, as the stars round the bend, they're going to have this centrifugal acceleration or force that tries to make the bend bigger, tries to smooth out the perturbation. And so you get that sort of instability in the bending for short wavelength systems. Whereas if you have a long wavelength bend, then you know your stars sort of move through and barely feel the bend at all. And so bending tends to be on smaller scales, whereas the genes instability is a long wavelength phenomena. So not only can we get these types of structures out of equilibrium models, but satellites can provoke both in-plane and vertical perturbations. And this is somewhat older work that I did with John Dubinsky and Jean-René Gauthier. I was a graduate student at Toronto many years ago, but I think it nicely illustrates how satellites can perturb and churn up a disk. And so you're seeing here the satellites are just really halo substructure passing through the disk of, this is actually an Andromeda type model. And it's this model, had we not built the substructure into the dark halo, wouldn't have formed a bar, but with the substructure, it forms a nice bar. And so one of these satellites seems to have come right through the center. And with just kind of a matching the orbital frequency of the bar excites bar formation in this galaxy. If you look at the system edge on, then it's not difficult to imagine how these satellites passing through the disk are just creating waves, the sort of ripple in a pond effect, creating these vertical oscillations in the galaxy. So that's what we think we're starting to see in Gaia data.
So are those satellites like live satellites? Or
so these are, everything's live. So basically the experiment was to take a galactics model with a smooth dark halo, take 10% of the mass of the halo and put it into clumps, little Plummer spheres of dark matter with some distribution of mass and something that would roughly match the subhalo mass function that we see in cosmological simulations. And just put them on random orbits and then just let them interact with the disk and see what happens to the disk. That was essentially the experiment.
I'm just surprised that there's like so many that stay alive, at small radii.
Well, it's in projection. So some of these are only coming through, right through the center. Certainly in that 2006 paper, we had lots of, Jean-Ray had lots of statistics on the survival fraction and how much of the mass remains, how many of these satellites are totally disrupted. And so I think we started with more substructure than the subhalo mass function that you find from cosmology, but at the end, we sort of ended up roughly where we thought, you would be with substructure.
So you said plumber sphere?
I think they were plumber sphere. Yeah, there's some sort of little NFW clumps or something like that.
One of our in the center or one of our R's, I forgot, but
I think it's flat in the center.
It's pretty flat in the center. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't quote me on plumber sphere, but.
So there are three ways that you get a structure in this. One is through instabilities, another through this. Satellites that come through, and then I guess another thing people talk about is giant molecular clouds.
Right.
So, I mean, which one is more important?
Which effect are we thinking about? I'll come to the, these satellites seem to be able to prompt bar formations, spiral structures, some of these big global structures, even to produce some of the more subtle things that I'll talk about in a moment, you still need sort of 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 solar mass satellites. I'm not sure how much substructure in the disk you can get out of giant molecular clouds. People have looked at these in terms of, you know, pumping up the vertical velocity dispersion and so forth. And I think they're important for some of the dynamics, but not for some of these larger scale features that we talked about. And instability is sort of tricky because these instabilities we're studying in pristine equilibrium models that then go unstable, and that's not how, you know, galaxies form. So we have to be a little careful about interpreting, you know, the instabilities are interesting because we learn something about dynamics of these systems, but you know, are we learning something about how the real galaxies form? Yeah.
So my question is, if we take whatever the small satellites we know and run the movie backwards for the Milky Way, do we get to a point where at some distant past, the disk becomes smoothish?
That sort of gets exactly to this point that we're doing experiments, but our experiments aren't, these aren't ab initio galaxy formation experiments. So I think that question would be answered by going to one of these big, cosmological simulations and studying how the disk forms and how, and are these interactions, what role do they play in an ab initio simulation, right? So, so merging has been going on throughout the history of the galaxy. I mean, the disk itself may have formed through some merger event. People are now talking about the Gaia sausage, with some merger event 10 billion years ago. And so, I wouldn't want to say that that there's a simplistic picture that the galaxy somehow had this early perfectly axisymmetric quiet stage, and then halos, substructures started coming in. But on the other hand, I think, spiral structure and so forth has to be continually excited, right? These structures live for a long time, but they don't live forever. And so you sort of need to keep producing things like spiral structure.
Question related to the spiral structure. There are types of galaxies, and you're the expert much more than me, but I believe there are types of galaxies where the spiral structure is only in blue light or is predominantly in blue light and not in density altogether. If your model involves only gravitational forces, how can you explain that?
I'm sorry, I didn't get it. So you're asking I think if you're asking, is disk dynamics, star formation, and so forth important for spiral structure? The answer is absolutely yes. Absolutely yes. Yeah. So spiral arms are, we think density waves passing through the disk, where you're getting enhanced star formation and sort of lighting up the disk with a lot of very bright, but not necessarily, it may be more spiral structure in light as opposed to density.
Right, you might think the star from the spiral structure was a consequence just of the feedback and the nonlinear dynamics, for example, from supernova.
That's right, so none of that is in these models. That's absolutely, true. Okay. Let's see, I think we're a little short on time. So I think I'm gonna jump through astrometric observations. Just point out that there's a revolution now that's taking place in making astrometric observations and observing the six-dimensional phase space of the galaxy. This is a time-honored bit of astronomy dating back to Tycho Brahe and others. One has to measure the angular position of stars, their radial velocity, the parallax, which can give you as well the distance, and also the proper motion. I just have to pause here to see you know, what proper motion does to the common constellations that we have. So that's 200,000 years. Gaia's measuring proper motions over 5 years. And so what is Gaia doing? Well, it's looking at stars which are making their little parallax circles, but also moving across the sky. So you get these curly patterns. But they're doing this on micro arc second scales. So, down to, I don't know, tens of meters or something on Mars, if you're looking at it. You can sort of pick how you want to explain just how remarkable that observation is. And this is just to illustrate the revolution that's taking place started with really Hipparchus and others, and now with Gaia, where we're getting something like a billion objects with parallax and proper motions measured down to these milli and micro arc second scales. So it's only 1% of the galaxies in the disk, but you are reaching with six-dimensional phase-space information more or less to the galactic center and out toward the edge of the disk. And all the data is being made public, so anyone can just plug in and download some Gaia data. It's a fun thing to do with an astronomy class and try some of your own ideas on galaxy dynamics. And so Gaia is already producing some interesting results. So here's this circular speed curve with the Gaia Gaia objects, and hopefully you can see this, that there's substructure in this circular speed curve. So there are these stripes which move roughly along constant angular momentum, and that may be an indication of disequilibrium in the galaxy and something going on in the galaxy. So we don't have a perfect smooth model. You can look at the RVR distribution. Yeah.
What are the different color codes,
I think it's just density of stars. So I think they're just sort of highlighting the number of stars in velocity radius. Right. So that's, so you can see, we got most of the stars right where the sun is, and then they're clustered around, 240 or so kilometers per second. But you are seeing some substructure in that. So here's the VRV phi distribution, this epicyclic motion from the galactics code, that quasi-isothermal model that we talked about. And this is what it actually looks like in the Gaia data. Although these moving groups have been known for many years now, astronomers can't help themselves and name what all of these clumps are in the RVR diagram. But we think that there's a lot of interesting dynamics here. These are stars, perhaps stars that cluster in phase space associated with different resonances with the galactic bar. And so you can start to test this doing detailed simulations and seeing if you do indeed get clustering in this part of phase space. People have detected what's been interpreted as bending waves in the disk of the galaxy, going back to Sloan and data. So structures bending of the disk at sort of 50 or 100 parsec level with wavelengths of a few kiloparsecs. So there seem to be ripples in the disk of the galaxy. And that takes me to sort of where my own interest in this problem began. It was a collaboration with Susan Gardner, Brian Yanni, Scott Dodelson, in which we were taking Segway data and looking, essentially we wanted to do the Oort problem again. We wanted to get the best determination of the local density of dark matter from Segway data using the fact that Segway had observations both above and below the galactic plane. And so we essentially were taking a projection of this ZVZ phase space down to a number density as a function of position relative to the galactic midplane. It was nicely fit with a thin disk, thick disk model, as Mike was mentioning earlier on. So the galaxy has, we think, these two distinct components of the disk. But then we noticed that there were these sort of 5 or 10% residuals, which had a kind of a little wavy structure to it as a function of Z. And that's now been confirmed by other people using Segway data and Gaia data and a number of other things. So this seems to be a real effect. There seems to be some sort of substructure or structure in the residuals of the vertical number counts of stars relative to the midplane of the galaxy.
Does this mean that you're actually in this experiment independently measuring the Newtonian potential?
So one is right. So one of the things, and at the end of the talk, I'll get to this. One of the things that we can do with this data is measure the Newtonian potential relative to the galactic midplane. Yeah. So that was the original thing, and then this was the annoying residuals that turned out to be sort of the more interesting part of the project. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out where these residuals would come from. We thought it's selection effects and all sorts of things, and then realized that actually there was some interesting physics to explore.
Okay, can you rule out the Mond hypothesis?
Can I? What's that?
Can you rule out the Mond hypothesis that?
We have not thought about a Mond connection with this. So, so we also saw some interesting effects in the mean vertical velocity that seemed to suggest that the galaxy was undergoing what you might call a breathing mode, as it seemed to be moving both north and south of the midplane. Seemed to be the bulk motion seemed to be moving away from the midplane of the galaxy. And that was something people saw in other surveys as well. Rave and a Chinese-American collaboration called LAMOST. And so there are interesting effects in the local velocity distribution of the galaxy. So now we come to the Gaia era. So here's the ZVZ phase space that we talked about earlier for a nice equilibrium model, roughly a Maxwellian-ish distribution. And this is what Gaia sees. And I'm hoping people can kind of see a faint spiral. Okay, I don't know how the lighting in this room works, but hopefully you can see a faint spiral in that distribution. And it seems certainly plausible that this north-south asymmetry that we saw in the number counts and the first moment, first velocity moment, are just the projections of that phase spiral. And had we had enough data at the time and thought about this a little bit more, one could have, you know, sort of had the idea that there was something like this going on, but we were just looking at various projections and trying to interpret it there. But now we have the full phase space. So now we have these beautiful phase spirals and you know, where does that come from? Well, where it comes from is almost certainly basic phase mixing. That is, if the potential in the midplane of the galaxy were a perfect harmonic potential and you disturb that equilibrium distribution in some way, then that disturbance would just rotate around in phase space. Since in a harmonic potential, all stars orbit at the same frequency. But if the potential is anharmonic, then of course, and anharmonic in the sense that the stars with larger vertical energy orbit more slowly in phase space, which is what you would expect, then they lag behind and you develop phase spirals very quickly. And so this is telling us something about sort of higher derivatives of the potential in the solar neighborhood, which is interesting. You immediately start to think about how to use this to get a better model for the local potential. So there are different questions that one might ask. So one is there a common origin or dynamical connection between some of the different manifestations of disequilibrium? You know, is there a connection between bar formation, which is an M equals 2 symmetric about the galactic midplane perturbation of the disk, and the warp, which is usually M equals 1 and anti-symmetric about the midplane of the disk, right? So warps go up on one side, down on the other. It's got M equals 1 symmetry, and it's anti-symmetric around the midplane. The bar and the spiral structure tends to be M equals 2 and symmetric about the midplane, but maybe they're connected through some nonlinear process in the dynamics of the galaxy. And this led a graduate student of mine, Keir Darling, down a path where we explored a machine learning method called dynamic mode decomposition, which people in plasma physics and fluid dynamics use all the time. It's related to Koopman theory, which is goes deep back to von Neumann and Koopman in the early days of quantum mechanics. But anyway, it's a way of using the machinery of eigenfunction decomposition on nonlinear systems by mapping your system onto a space of observables and then writing down a linear operator in that space, in that infinite space of observables, and using sort of standard techniques of eigen decomposition. And so it's something I'm still exploring and be happy to talk to people about this afterwards. But I think that it has not been used in astrophysics except sort of that one paper that we wrote. The other question you might have is, are the corrugations in the disk and the local phase spirals transient phenomena from some recent event, or is the disk just continually being disrupted? And so should we just think of the disk as undergoing constant perturbations, and occasionally you form these little phase spirals and waves and so forth? Or is there some hope of finding, you know, that one satellite galaxy that came through that did the damage and caused a lot of these features? You know, there's certainly no shortage of satellite galaxies out there that might be suspects for driving these perturbations. And there's been a whole sort of industry around Sagittarius and the large and small Magellanic clouds on whether they may be the architect of some of the structure in the Milky Way, such as the bar, the spiral arms, the north-south asymmetry, or the phase spirals, and so forth. I'll only say, though, that the simulations that people have done where they've thrown satellites into one of these galaxies and asked, do we form the phase spirals that we see in the Gaia data, have had some qualitative success, but tend to miss some of the details of the spirals seen by Antoja in the Gaia data. And for an interesting, I guess, sense of the failure of this, there's a nice paper by Morgan Bennett, just recent PhD student of Joe Bovey's at Toronto, in which they and with Jason Hunt and Joe have tried to reproduce these phase spirals in these simulations and have been unsuccessful, but I think in a very interesting way. So there's still something to try to explain. Can we construct a model that produces the phase spirals that we see in the Gaia data? And there's also a question of whether self-gravity is important. So, you know, that little cartoon that I showed of phase wrapping was just particles in a background potential. But if you throw in self-gravity, then things get more complicated. Since we're just about out of time, let me just mention this revisiting the Oort problem, which is this idea, this aim to simultaneously infer the local gravitational potential and distribution function of a tracer population of stars using the Gaia data. And we did this with Gaia DR2. This is my graduate student, Kevin Lee. But everyone in the field is anxiously awaiting DR3, which comes out in June. In fact, we're trying to get a pre-ER3 paper out in the next month or two. So previous attempts to infer the local potential either inferred the distribution function and the potential separately. They used sort of different pieces of the same data set or different data sets, or they were methods based on the moments of the distribution function, the genes equations. And our method tries to actually extract the local potential by looking at the full vertical phase space. And a key thing of this model is that we get the residuals in the phase space, and the residuals are the phase spiral. So this just gives you a sense. Here's the color magnitude diagram from Gaia, and that red box is what we've used, but lots of people have done this ORT problem with different parts of the color magnitude diagram. We have a model for the vertical potential, which has been used previously, but it has this departure from a harmonic potential, which allows you to get a better model for the gravitational potential. But you know, we know now is there because of the phase spirals. Mike asked earlier about the thin disk and thick disk, but we now think that that may be an oversimplification of the galactic disk. This is work by Joe Bovey, and the top panel shows a run of vertical velocity dispersion as a function of height, and there's a slight trend in all of these different components, and the different colors are different components of the disk as labeled by chemical abundances, you know, alpha to iron ratios and so forth. And so they're all roughly constant, as they're all sort of approximately isothermal, but there are clear trends as you go through different populations of the disk. And so instead of maybe a thin disk, thick disk, what we should really think about is a continuum of populations with different velocity dispersions and different chemical abundances. And so we've invented just a phenomenological model that captures this, that allows you to sum up a continuum of different stellar populations with different velocity dispersions, which we think matches the data. So we then model the local phase space density, extract the gravitational potential and vertical force. Our results are, I think, consistent with what other people have found with, again, different methods, genes, equations, and so forth. So the top curve is the vertical potential, and the bottom curve is the vertical force. And it's the vertical force that's probably the most direct measure of the total surface density between you and the galactic midplane. So that's what you would use. Subtract off what the baryon contribution is, and what's left over you can attribute to dark matter. So that's the ORT problem. So here's the data, here's the model. So again, we're modeling the full phase space distribution function and the gravitational potential simultaneously. And here are the residuals, which beautifully show the phase spirals that were seen in the Gaia data. And I think one of the neat things about this is we have the distribution function, we have the gravitational potential, therefore we can calculate things like angle action variables and frequencies and start to use these more dynamically important quantities. And so this phase spiral that we see, if you plot it as a function of the vertical frequency and the angle of angle action variables, unwraps into straight lines, and the slope of that line can tell you something about the age of the perturbation. And we're now trying to do this in three dimensions. And so get the full three-dimensional gravitational potential, and then full six-dimensional phase-space distribution function, and then plot the residuals in angle action variables in all three actions and three angles. So that's the goal. And our decomposition in terms of different stellar populations also seems to work reasonably well. So as I just mentioned, the next step is to go beyond this 1D model. And Toha and company found the phase spirals and number counts. But what was really remarkable was that when they plotted the mean radial velocity in the same space, the spirals popped out even more. And so if you plot the mean radial velocity or mean azimuthal velocity as a function of ZVZ, you also saw these spirals. So these spirals are not a vertical phenomena. This is more complicated motion, coupling the epicyclic motion and the vertical motion. And so, you know, we're trying to sort of reproject all of this into the full 6D phase space. Okay, so here's my summary slide. So as I see it, you know, this is roughly where we are in this area of galactic dynamics and galactic disequilibrium. We have all of these different features of the galaxy, these phase spirals and moving groups in the RVR or VRV5 plane, the warping of the disk, bars and ripples and so forth. And we're trying to understand what the big picture is. Are we seeing Sagittarius coming through? Or are we seeing the effect of lots of substructure continually passing through the disk and continually exciting these perturbations? So it seems that the prospects for rapid progress are good. In the coming years, Gaia will provide full phase space measurements for 100 times more stars than we have available at the present. We don't see this a lot in physics, where you get two orders of magnitude or three orders of magnitude jump in data in a couple of years, but it's absolutely amazing result. But it'll take a major effort to combine theory, simulations, and data science to piece it all together. So I think you know, we're in a happy position of having too much data, and it's the theorists that are desperately trying to keep up with all this. So I think I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Okay, so we are 6 minutes over. We've been peppering Larry with questions. So how about we eventually stop the recording here? And then people have further questions, we can ask Larry over lunch. Okay, so thanks again, Larry. So-